Hello, it's Thursday, July the 29th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. We'll be getting the latest from the Olympics. Silver medal today. Team GB still doing very well. How the government has been shamed into offering sanctuary to more Afghan translators who worked with our troops in that terrible war. On the environment, you've only got to look out of the window to see the weather's been changing fast. I'm going to be speaking to a former leader of the Green Party about the consequences. On the Olympics, it's silver medal, so we're still doing very well. Northern accents, why are they set to disappear? Not for 45 years, but I don't think they should disappear at all. But first, at last, Britain is opening for business with visitors from Europe and the US no longer having to self-isolate on arrival in the UK. So why can't we go to the EU countries in the same way? So at last, fully vaccinated visitors from Europe and the United States will no longer have to self-isolate on arrival in the UK. The ban on international cruise travel is also to be ended next week. The government hopes they're now helping areas dependent on tourism and also international students can return. But is this a case of too little, too late for the beleaguered travel industry? Paul Charles is a travel expert and he's chief executive of the PC agency who's been campaigning to get Britain opened up. Paul, you must be relieved on the one hand, finally, from Monday, we can have people coming in from Europe and the United States. But it's not the other way around yet. So there are still problems with people who want to go to France and we still don't know whether Spain is going to go on Amber Plus.
Yes, so many issues still in travel. It's not a quiet summer. Remember those days many years ago when you could go away and not worry about these? But undoubtedly, the government still has many issues to deal with. Obviously, it's great to see the borders opening up safely to EU and US citizens who can obviously from Monday come in. But yes, there are still many issues. There's testing and the cost of testing. There's the fact that we can't go to the US unless we launder our status somewhere else for 14 days before going into the US. And of course, Spain itself is seeing rising infections, but I don't think it's going to be added to Amber Plus next week. I think that's a category the government has totally misjudged, introduced late on a Friday night. You know, it was a panic measure. And I think France will come off the Amber Plus category and it will be quietly put through the back door and shelved.
I was talking to some people who are holidaying in France and Spain and they were hoping that friends were going to join them. And they said the holiday has been completely ruined because everybody is anxious that the government is going to change the rules, the regulations and the quarantine rules. Perhaps next week when they do review the traffic light list, they may make some statement saying that's it now. Unless there's a dramatic deterioration, we're not going to change the rules and give people, as you say, Friday night, late night, France goes on Amber Plus and giving people just a couple of days to get back.
Oh, if only that were the case. I think government's going to continue to be a little bit cautious, going to continue to provide traffic light updates every 2 or 3 weeks. If only we could remove the stress. It was, of course, very stressful last summer with the travel corridors where many people were stuck and distressed and had financial costs at the last minute. The same is going to apply, sadly, this year, where people are on the edge of their seats waiting to see if their country is going to go red, amber or green. It's no way to run a policy. This traffic light system, as I've said before, is failing and it's not working in the way it should be. The government have really messed this up, I'm afraid, and it would be much easier if they simply had a go-no-go situation and policy like America does, where American citizens, if they're fully jabbed, can pretty well go everywhere as long as they take tests when they come back. I hope the UK would move more towards that sort of situation, but there's no immediate sign of the traffic light system being abandoned, sadly.
How important is it for the tourism industry that we are now allowing double vaxxed people from the EU and the US to come to Britain from next week? Because while we often think about our holidays abroad, tourism, inward tourism to this country is hugely important to our economy. And I was just thinking about a lot of the West End shows are starting to reopen and they need tourists so badly.
Well, judging by the reaction today from US and EU citizens already booking hotels in Windsor and Bath and Cheltenham and all those sorts of places that rely on US visitors, then it's already a good move. The value of the inbound tourist is around £28 billion a year. certainly it was pre-pandemic, to the UK economy. So it's a big win for the UK government to move in this direction and also to get buy-in from Scotland and perhaps a bit reluctantly Wales. But they are valuable visitors. The inbound market is critical. Just look at an airline like Virgin Atlantic. If they fly outbound to the US pretty empty because UK visitors can't go in, at least they can fly back from the US pretty full because US citizens can come in here. So it's a major victory for the industry after months of lobbying and torrid difficulties in the industry, and it's going to help to salvage the summer.
Just finally, I don't want to drag you into a political arena, but the Labour Party has said, it's the word they keep using about the lifting of restrictions. They said when the Prime Minister lifted the restrictions on July the 19th, reckless. The Deputy Labour leader, Angela Rayner, is saying again, allowing people to come in from EU countries is reckless. I don't know what they're getting at. I think they're worrying that perhaps from other countries in the world, the vaccines they use perhaps aren't as effective as AstraZeneca and Pfizer. But how do you view the fact that the official opposition is effectively trying to keep Britain closed down?
It does seem remarkable because they are not representing their constituents. So many of them work in the travel and tourism sector. 1 in 10 people work in that sector. So I don't believe the Labour leadership are reflecting what many people in the UK are actually thinking, because they need their jobs. So we need to open up borders, and it can be done safely. Yes, of course, there are some vaccines out there, beginning with an S, which aren't allowed in this country, and therefore the airlines themselves shouldn't be letting in passengers who've had those vaccines. So, of course, they will be checking at the departure point for any sign of that and that the vaccine's being shown on the certificates are valid. But I don't think there's the risk that there was. I think we've moved on. We're now living in a COVID world. This policy is that in action.
And at last, we seem to be starting to open for business.
Yeah, it's a really good feeling, actually. I'm currently talking to you from Regent Street in central London. I haven't seen it this busy since March last year. And I can tell those aren't just British pedestrians out on the streets pounding the pavements. They're definitely overseas visitors. There's a feeling that they're back in already. Lots of Americans already coming into the UK anyway, even before the change in the rules next Monday. And there's a feeling that we're starting to get back to some sort of normality, which is obviously badly needed in the travel sector.
Quite agreed, quite agreed. That's Paul Charles, who is the Chief Executive of the PC Agency. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. All you really got to do is look out the window or listen to the news. It's enough to tell you that there's something changing with our weather. London, at times, the floods have been positively biblical. Last year, 2020, was the third warmest, fifth wettest and eighth sunniest on record, according to the latest UK State of the Climate report. Natalie Bennett is a Green Party peer and a former leader of the Green Party, and she joins me now. Natalie, even the Prime Minister's advisor on the big conference on climate change in Scotland later this year, Allegra Stratton, said if people care about climate change, they should consider voting for the Green Party. She also said vote Tory too. You must have been quite encouraged by that.
Well, I think she went even further than that. I think if people were concerned about it, she said they should join the Green Party, and to have right. You know, the official spokesperson of the COP saying that, I'm very pleased, very happy with that. And I admit we've been sharing that on social media quite a lot.
I thought you might.
But I think, but more seriously, in terms of action, what we want to see from the government is not even words like saying join the Green Party. What we want to see is genuine action on this climate emergency, which is just what we're not seeing now. I mean, I just had an answer to a written question I put in a couple of weeks ago saying, where is our heat and building strategy? The answer was, it will arrive in due course. And this is something that was originally expected 2 or 3 years ago. We're just not seeing the kind of urgency. We're not seeing any real action from the government. At all. Fine words are fine, but they're ultimately just hot air.
And we talking about Allegra Stratton, and I don't want to make this interview just about her, but I thought she wrote the most extraordinary piece in one of the national newspapers the other day, Natalie, where she suggested don't rinse the plate off before you put it in the dishwasher, because that will help the environment. I thought she might have actually said turn the dishwasher off and just wash your dishes, okay, when you've got a whole sink full.
Well, actually, without getting too sidetracked into the whole issue of dishwashers, looking at the bigger, which can actually be more energy and water efficient than hand washing.
Right.
But without getting sidetracked into that, what I think is really disturbing, and if that reflects what's being thought at the heart of government, that's a very old-fashioned, discredited idea that came from that period. People will recall where at one stage we were all getting random low-energy light bulbs being delivered to us by way of the energy companies. And people said, well, if that's all you've got to do for climate change, well, that can't be really very serious. You know, that's what the government's saying they have to do. And of course, what we're talking about, the very common, long-used green phrase is climate system change, not climate change. We are currently, vastly exceeding our planet's limits on carbon emissions, on many other things too, whether it's the collapse of biodiversity and bioabundance, whether it's plastics turning our oceans into a plastic soup, whether it's trashing our soils. We need to see an entire change of system. And it's really deeply damaging to suggest to people, you've just got to make a few small changes here and there. And the other thing it doesn't address is that what we've done now is trashed the planet and created a thoroughly miserable, unequal society. We can make changes that will make our lives better, not that little changes that will clog up our dishwashers.
Yeah, and what of the revelation in the papers this week? You'll have followed it, I'm sure, that the government now is going cold on its plan to, for instance, we all thought we were going to have to get rid of our gas boilers to comply with their environmental targets by, let me think, was it 2030? 2030. Yeah. And now the Prime Minister is saying that all of that's going to be delayed for at least 5 years because he's obviously finally done some research and realised the alternatives, for instance, could cost as much as £20,000. That is a vote loser for any Conservative government, probably for any government. What's your view on that, Natalie?
Well, what they were always talking about was actually that if you went to replace one, so it wasn't a case of, if you put one in last year, you'd have to rip it out. It was a case that when you came to replace them, or indeed particularly when you were building new homes, that what you would have is air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, those kind of arrangements. But once again, we're in a situation where we're just so lacking in joined up government. We had the Green Homes grant that was a total collapse, total failure. They spent about a tenth of the money that they were planning to, and the whole scheme was an unmitigated disaster. That should have been helping to insulate homes that then mean that you can actually use these systems, which really require decently insulated, well-built homes, which we don't have in the UK at the moment. We have some of the worst housing stock in Western Europe. So we need to tackle that. We need to have the skills. I'm involved in the House of Lords at the moment in the Skills and Post-16 Education Bill. And we're pushing the government with amendments to say we need to be prepared for the climate emergency, the nature crisis. We need to give people these skills. We need people to be able to look at a Victorian terrace to understand what needs to be done in terms of insulation, how you can actually put in, say, an air source heat pump, get a system that will actually make people far more comfortable and will save them a heap of money. But it's a whole systems thing. It's not just a simple rip one thing out and put something else back in.
What do you say to those people who say, it doesn't matter what Britain do because our contribution to global warming, climate change, it probably counts for 1%. We need China, who've ignored all these international treaties. The United States, well, Biden will take America back into the Paris Accord. But India, if these countries don't get to grips with the environmental issue, it doesn't matter what we do here.
I think there's three things to say about that. First of all, a huge amount of the historic emissions and carbon dioxide emissions stay up there in the atmosphere for 100 years. A huge amount of the historic emissions are ours, so we have a responsibility for that. Secondly, what Britain does, we are a real centre of global media. What happens in Britain gets covered in around the rest of the world far more than what happens in, say, France or Germany. So we can have a real position of world leadership, and we have a responsibility to show that leadership as the chair of COP26. The world made us the chair of the climate talks with the responsibility for leading. And I was recently at an event with Mary Robinson, the former Irish president, very respected international figure, chair of the elders. She really very directly gave me a message to take back to the government saying, you've got to sort your domestic policies out if you're going to have a successful COP, if you're going to have the moral legitimacy that you need to have to be a chair of COP.
And just finally, Natalie, some of us, me included, were thinking, I know I shouldn't moan about the weather, but 31 degrees in London, it was hotter than that in other parts of the country, too hot. There are reports that UK summer temperatures could reach 40 degrees centigrade within a decade. Now, that really would be very unpleasant. And do you think, unless action is taken, that is going to be an inevitable fact?
Exactly right. And the British Red Cross had a very good report out a couple of days ago pointing out that, you know, this is actually deadly. Last summer already there were 2,000 or 2,500 excess deaths could be attributed to the heat. Predictions are it could be 7,000 a year by 2050. And there was a study showing that most over 75s don't realise how biologically vulnerable they are to these. If you've got heart disease or kidney disease, heat can exacerbate those. And the Committee on Climate Change was pointing out that we've built in the last few years 500,000 new homes that don't have the features that could actually cope with the heat. So we're essentially building sweat boxes that people will suffer in. And as so many things with the climate emergency, you know, the buzzword is co-benefits. There's lots of things that we can do to tackle the climate emergency that also make our lives better, more comfortable, and, you know, create lots of jobs and business opportunities.
All right, that's Baroness Natalie Bennett. She's a former leader of the Green Party and leading figure of the Green Party today. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. Ministers have been frankly shamed into granting more Afghan translators asylum in the United Kingdom. It comes after more than 40 senior British Army officers submitted a letter to the Prime Minister saying the country risks dishonour, strong words indeed, if the translators were left behind, potentially to be murdered by the Taliban. Mark Nicol is the Mail's defence and diplomacy editor, and he joins me now. This is a really unedifying episode, isn't it, in diplomatic relations?
Indeed. It's gone from being quite a niche defence issue to one which is now in the realm of overall government competence, because it will be ghastly should any of those interpreters who we have not yet given sanctuary to, if anything happens to them, particularly now that UK and other Western troops have moved out, we will be to blame. And the dishonour claim is a very serious one, but I think it sticks. And I think it hurt too, I think.
What I don't understand, Mark, it would be so easy for the government to get them out of there with their families. They served the army well, bravely. When they are talking about potentially allowing 2 million Chinese people from Hong Kong to come here, and yet here we're talking about just 1,000 interpreters.
That would be an all-round figure for not just interpreters and their families, but other locally employed workers as well. The Americans are moving towards a much simpler solution, which we should also be adopting, which is you get them out, i.e. you get them to safety, be it to a third country, or be it to this country, where their claims can be assessed in safety and with time on our side. And the majority, I'm sure, will be verified and they will be permitted to stay. And a very small minority may have to go back. But that's a much more practical solution than what we're running now. Right. We've got quite a complicated bureaucratic process. A lot of paperwork's required. Often that paperwork doesn't exist anymore. Mm. And we're doing it with the sands in the timer ticking through now, with the Taliban gaining increasing amounts of territory within Afghanistan, and everybody is worried that many interpreters will be still remaining in Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban can really, really cause them difficulties.
And I'm reading here, Mark, 7 coalition translators are thought to have been murdered by the militants this year alone.
Yeah.
7?
Yeah.
That is really scandalous. Now, within hours of that letter being released, which really was tough and didn't pull its punches.
No.
There was emergency meetings called. Do you think they just thought this was going to go away in the Ministry of Defence?
I think they probably did. They launched this policy called ARAP, Afghan Relocation Scheme, in early May. Mm. And we all applauded it because it was seen to be a simpler solution than what they've been running before. But month by month, it is still rejecting a lot of genuine people. And they're having to prove, one, that they were in an exposed role at the time when they worked for us. Mm. Two, that they are now in imminent danger. Now, that can be difficult to prove. It's also similarly difficult to disprove. And they also, another problem is that 35% of our interpreters and others were terminated at some point from service.
Yeah.
Not because they did anything particularly wrong, but often new units would come in and they wouldn't necessarily want to inherit the Afghans who worked for a previous unit. They would want to get their own. And so this meant that these people were let go. And until very recently, none of the terminated translators have been able to get a look in under this scheme. And that's wrong. And then we are a responsibility to these people, so we have to sort it out quickly.
Does Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, say it's not my fault, Gov, it's the Foreign Office or it's Number 10? I mean, where does the blame for this mess ultimately end up, Mark?
I think whoever came up with this ARAP scheme, which is highly administrational and bureaucratic, carries some blame. But there are multiple government departments involved, also the Home Office, the Foreign Office, and the local government office, which is responsible for housing, because there is a lot to do once they get here. Obviously, they're quarantining at the moment because Afghanistan is a red list country. But then after that, they have to find housing for them. And you can appreciate that's not easy. But the imperative now is to get them out of Afghanistan before the Taliban is at the gates of Kabul. Because when they are, the British Embassy won't be able to function properly. And the British Embassy is obviously running this whole scheme.
And of course, the Mail campaign, it was called Betrayal of the Brave. Yeah. And that's exactly what it's been, Betrayal of the Brave.
It has been. And credit to the Daily Mail, because now this is a huge international issue. It wasn't when David Williams, he's the one who deserves the credit, started writing about this about 7 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Well done. Keep up the pressure. The Mail will certainly keep up the pressure. That's Mark Nicol, the Mail's Defence and Diplomacy Editor. Thanks for joining us. So it's day 6 of the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Of course, Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest. No golds.
No golds. No, I know. We've been on bit spoiled over the last few days with a bit of a gold rush, and we'd had a sort of a gold every day for the last 4 or 5, but none overnight. We weren't hugely expected any, so it's not like anyone's massively underperformed, but a couple of great stories. A silver in the canoeing, which was a great effort for Mallory Franklin, who it was a great spectacle because she went down, set the fastest time, and then was waiting all the time. Everyone was coming down after her. No one was beating her, so she was sitting in the gold medal position until the last run, where, to be fair, it was the favourite, the Australian girl, Fox, who came down and beat her time, so knocking her into silver. But still, great effort to win silver for her. It's her first Olympics. She's a 27-year-old from Windsor.
Very good.
Was delighted. So,
and did we get a bronze as well?
And we got a bronze in the shooting. So that was a good story as well. So a lad called Matt Coward Holly, who was in his first Olympics as well.
Right.
Yeah. Now, he, 10 years ago, broke his back playing rugby. He'd always wanted to be a rugby player, wanted to be play for England, had set his targets on that. Broke his back, was lying in a hospital bed. So, never thought he'd, was told basically, you're not going to play rugby. Mm. So took up sort of shooting as a way of helping him during his recovery process. And today, won a bronze medal, so good on him. Now, he was one of the he was sort of touted as possibly winning a gold, but he started a bit nervously, missed a few of his targets early on. But
what do they shoot? They shoot to target.
They were shooting, clay pigeon shooting, basically.
Oh, are they?
It's called the men's trap. So they're shooting clay pigeons, moving at a rate of knots across his eye line, bang out the sky. And he missed the first few, so he obviously started with a few nerves.
Yeah.
But
have you ever been shooting?
I have, actually, yeah.
Mm. I've been invited, but I've declined.
I've done it once, and it's not as easy as it looks.
No, that's why I've declined.
It actually hurts.
Yeah, the vibration on the shoulder.
Back into the shoulder is pretty painful. So,
Did you shoot anything? Did you kill anything?
Did I, heck? No,
you missed.
I nearly killed the tutor. That was about as close as I got.
Tomorrow will be another big day. Are we expecting more medals tomorrow, Matt? Friday?
So, there's hope of medals almost overnight. So they're in the pool again. Obviously, we rule the pool now, as you know. We are the masters of the pool. So Duncan Scott, who came runner-up the other day to Tom Dean, well, he's going again in the 200-metre individual medley.
Right.
So that's where he has to do 4 different strokes. So he is a medal hope, and there's 3 or 4 others. Three or four other hopes in the pool as well. And Dina runs overnight.
She's the sprinter.
She's the sprinter.
High hope for a gold.
Yeah, high hopes. Now, she's only going in the heats overnight, so she's in the 100-meter heats overnight.
Right.
The final of that is over the weekend, I think. Now, high hopes for a gold. She's got a really strong field. It's not as strong as it could be because the American girl Richardson's out because she failed a drugs test just before the Olympics.
Well, ban her for life then.
Cannabis, yeah. So she failed.
Yeah.
But she is up against Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, who won the Olympic gold in Beijing and London. And she's the favourite. So Dina will do well to win gold, but she's certainly a medal hope. But it's only the heats overnight. She's actually got a better chance in the 200 metres, which she's running in, that's next week. So,
all right.
Plenty to come.
That's Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor. Be back with me tomorrow on day 7.
Yes, something like that. They're so coming thick and fast, it's hard to know where we're at.
Even I'm excited.
Good.
All right, then. Thank you. Accents, all important, aren't they? But in fact, distinct northern accents like Scouse and Geordie, they could be gone for good in as little as 45 years, according to a new study. Using physics modelling, researchers from the universities of Portsmouth and Cambridge have predicted how accents are likely to change across England. Dr. James Burridge is a reader in probability and statistical physics at the University of Portsmouth, and he's one of those behind the research, and he joins me now. Dr. Burridge, you and I speak to each other with bland, boring southern accents, but your research is suggesting those lovely, rich northern dialects and accents are fading out. Why?
Well, the physics explanation is that dialects and accents are a result of local copying. So people when they learn to speak, they like to line their speech up with what they hear around them.
Yeah.
And when people aren't moving around very much, as has been the case if you go further back into the past, that meant that you could get lots of distinctly local forms of alignment in different places in the country. But as the rate of migration and movement of people around the country has grown, those very small local distinctive areas have expanded and features have taken over other features. And gradually we're losing this diversity and getting a more uniform and simple picture.
That's quite interesting because, I mean, I know that I've got a great friend who's from near Sunderland, and he speaks, when I see him, he sounds to me like he's got a northern accent. When he comes back, when he goes home to Sunderland, he comes back, he's much more pronounced. His accent is much more pronounced. And then, of course, it just starts fading back again.
Yes, well, we believe that the most plastic time in your language learning abilities is when you're quite young, so, you know, an adolescent or younger, and that's when you form most of your linguistic features. But that doesn't mean that later in life you can't adapt to your local environment, and certainly people do that. But when you relax, you're likely to regain some of those features that you learned in your youth, even if you suppress them. Later on.
So has this been happening over a number of years, Dr. Burridge, the beginning to see the fading of these distinctive northern accents? Because the number of people going to university, for instance, has dramatically increased. Many of them might be going to Oxford or Cambridge or universities in the south. And the labour force has been much more mobile, certainly since I've been at work in the last 40 years.
Yes, so our study really focused on the 20th century. So we took a huge dialect survey that was actually carried out in the 1950s, but it surveyed quite old people then. So it really captures the state of the language much earlier in the century. And then there was huge diversity. And over the 20th century, that diversity has disappeared largely, leaving some, geographical variation by the 20th century, by the end of the 20th century, but nowhere near as much. And our sort of approach was to treat the maps as the outputs of a physics model, a model of alignment, which interestingly produces bubble surfaces. That's the fundamental thing that's changing, these boundaries between different language regions, and evolved those bubbles through the 20th century. The answer to your question is there was a huge amount of diversity 100 years ago. Lots of it's gone. And if you run our model forward into the future, even more of it goes. But there are some special features that, for certain reasons that are to do with physics, are extremely stable.
Well, what are they?
So I think you and I probably say bath for
yes,
the
I
big
do.
Metal thing that you wash.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah.
But there is a line stretching from the wash on the east coast down to the River Severn on the west coast. And when you cross that line, fairly quickly, you go from saying, people go from saying bath to bath.
Yeah.
And that's called the trap bath split.
Right. Okay.
Now, unlike many other lines, that one seems to be very, very stable. And one of the reasons for that is it is like the surface of a bubble. And like bubbles, it gets trapped by indentations. Okay, so the indentations in the coastline on the east and west coast hold the bubble in place. And whatever forces there are from the southeast trying to push the bubble north, and lots of other bubbles have been pushed north, it's being stopped. And so there's the indentation effect, and there's also the effect that because that line divides the country roughly in half, the migration from the north and the migration from the south have approximately an equal effect. So there's no net push on the bubble.
Right.
Whereas other things, that's not true of other variants. So once you're down to quite a small area of the country, if you've got a linguistic feature which is covering quite a small area, it's much more vulnerable to migration because most of the people coming in aren't using it. And so when the children in the area are learning, they're exposed to a lot of alternative ways of alternative features, and that can disrupt the learning process and you lose the feature.
And what sort of, just finally, Dr. Burridge, is there anything that can be done to stop the decline of the distinctive northern accent? Clearly, people are going to continue to move around the country. Obviously, the mobility will continue, although perhaps post-pandemic, a lot of people may be working from home in future. But is there anything, do you think, that can halt this?
Well, so there are lots of things that push accents in different directions, you know, push particular features up and down in popularity. So, I mean, other than people just stopping moving, pride in the accent, and the accent having a social status and being desirable amongst local people and seen as something you want to demonstrate that you have, that's the key, you know.
Yeah.
So that can overcome the migration effect if people are proud of their accent. And in fact, there are examples in linguistics of this happening. So there's a place in America, Martha's Vineyard, where the accent actually reversed after lots of tourists started coming, because the locals wanted to sort of prove that they were the real locals.
Yeah,
so these effects can happen if people have enough pride in their accents. That can fight back against the kind of forces of physics.
Perhaps we need another Northern Prime Minister in Number 10 Downing Street. We haven't had one since Harold Wilson with his hat and his pipe. He had a very distinctive accent. The last two male Prime Ministers have been Old Etonian. David Cameron Tony Blair went to a posh school, Fetters, which was the Scottish Eton. Perhaps that's what we need, Dr. Burridge, a Northerner in Number 10 who's out and proud about his accent. Or hers, of course.
Yeah, no, I mean, that would be great. You know, the North is a great place, and It deserves to be on the rise.
Absolutely. That's Dr. James Burridge, who, like me, speaks with a Southern accent, who's a reader in probability and statistical physics at the University of Portsmouth, on this fascinating research about the demise of the Northern accent. Thanks for joining us. That's all we have time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.